After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to the Be Here Now Network guest podcast. This series features talks from a myriad of modern spiritual teachers expanding on how we can all live a life in balance. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/guest.
On this episode of the Be Here Now Network's guest podcast, Gil Fronsdal examines the hindrances of the mind which make it difficult for us to be mindful and present.
Sitting here these days with you, one of the strong feelings that I have is a lot of gratitude for all of you. And it's very meaningful for me that you and people like you take a month or 2 months from your life to engage in this very profound practice, this very profound meeting of yourself. And I think it's one of the beautiful things you do for yourself, but also a beautiful thing you do for others to do this kind of deep work, deep encounter. To borrow from vocabulary, a word that's often referred to in Buddhism, I think it's a very noble thing to do, to be on retreats like this. There's a lot of nobility in taking the time out and arranging one's life and coming and doing this process. I know some of you probably don't feel noble at all today, and probably thinking that you can't be talking about me because I'm just a mess. But I do talk about all of you. I know how difficult it can be. And I think it's because of the difficulties that staying here, showing up here, encountering oneself, looking at those difficulties is a noble thing to do. If you came here, it was just easy. Just like, you know, breeze, come in here, sit down, samadhi, whew, just like that, you know. In and out of here in a couple of days, going with... You know, you can get on with your life. I'm sure you have important things to do. You know, then I wouldn't have so much gratitude. Or so much awe and appreciation. It is difficult. So the topic of today is the difficulties, and in the form of the hindrances. It's a topic we cover every retreat, And the hindrances are kind of an umbrella topic that encompasses a wide range of experiences we have on practice. But most simply, the hindrances are those forces of the mind that make it very hard for us to be present, to be mindful. And when we are present, they hinder our ability to be present in a wise way. And in fact, the word for hindrances in Pali, Nivarana, means to cover over. It's a variety of things it covers, but it covers over our capacity to see clearly, make wise choices. It covers over our capacity to be present, because we can get caught up and lost in our concerns. In a number of places, many places, the Buddha uses the analogy of water for practice, for the mind. And concentration practice is referred to in symbolisms of water. And the hindrances also use the water analogy. And so if you take a pond of water, a pool, a lake of water, to be troubled by the first hindrance of desire, it's like putting a dye into the lake and colors it. You don't really see the lake, see it clearly for what it is, because you see it through rose-colored glasses. So it's the effect of being caught up in desire. Ill will, which is the second hindrance, or aversion sometimes it's called, it's like having the heating up the lake and the water roils, bubbling up, and you can't see clearly either because of all the heat. The third, sloth and torpor, is like lots of algae growing all over the top of the lake. So not only can't you see into the lake properly, but it's like you can't hardly swim through it. It just kind of bogs you down, kind of. And then the fourth hindrance is restlessness and anxiety. And that is likened like a wind. A strong wind blows across the surface of the lake, and it's all churned up from that. So it's good. And the fifth of these challenges is doubt. And doubt is like the lake is full of mud. And you step into the lake, and you can barely kind of take a next step because it's just so muddy and gucky and quicksandy. And maybe quicksand, more like mud, more like quicksand. And so all these analogies point to the fact we can't see clearly. The water of our mind is not clear, not pure. And part of what we do in practice is to purify that water, purify the mind. And it's can be at times a very powerful process of purification that goes on here in this practice. To meet ourselves, to see ourselves, to try to be still, try to be mindful, is so radically different from how many people live their normal lives. That it's not just simply the difficulty of the transition, but it's really encountering some of the deep-held habits, resistances, fears, holding patterns, stored-up legacies of a lifetime that are just ready to kind of come forth, and they can come forth in very powerful ways that sometimes can be quite challenging. One of them, what's interesting to mention, I think, is that there's a variety of different kinds of body pains and tensions that can reveal themselves on retreat. Some of them might be structural, maybe the way you sit, and maybe it's useful to have someone check your posture. But oftentimes it has to do with holding patterns. And chronically held muscles go numb. And what we want is the body, the mind, everything to wake up again. In the process of those numb muscles waking up, becoming sensitive again, goes through a period of pain. And so the fact that you start having some pain in your muscles is not necessarily a sign that things are worse and getting terrible for you, but rather is a sign that actually it's getting better because you're beginning to wake up and you have to go through this phase of working with that challenge. So that's part of the purification process of clarifying, relaxing, deepening. One of the aspects of the five hindrances is they belong to the land of about, the about land. And many of you have been visiting the world of about. And some of you are You know, that's where your, basically your citizenship belongs to them. You're tried and true, ready to defend your country at all costs, the world of about. And what that means is that when you're thinking about something, then you're in the world of about. If you're thinking about something and really living in that world and that concerns, then you're in that world of about. So if you're thinking about what was for dinner today, for supper, then you're not here with attention, but you're focusing on something that your mind is about. You're about dinner. If you're thinking about what happened last year, you're in the world of about. If you're thinking about what's going to happen at your next interview with a teacher, you're in the world of about land. If you are thinking about how much sleep you need to get or don't need to get or something, you're in the world of about land. If you're thinking about your pain, you're also thinking about something in the about land. If you're thinking about what a terrible meditator you are, or what a great meditator you are, that's what it's about. You're in the world of about land. You're in that about land world. And it's possible to get pulled into that world of about land, so there's no other land. And the land that is we're trying to inhabit on this retreat is the land of here, here land. There's here land and there's about land. And there's a huge difference between those two worlds. And one of the things about the about land is it's really great at camouflaging itself. So we go in there and we don't realize we're in there because we're just you're there. There's not that kind of awareness sometimes. Or sometimes there is awareness that we're in the world of about land, but that the awareness is not that strong. Or we haven't understood the nature of that awareness that sees, oh, I'm thinking about dinner, I'm thinking about my interview. There's something very special about the awareness that knows and sees that. And what we're trying to do here in this retreat is to come back and discover what's so special about awareness, about mindfulness, presence, about here land. And this is not a casual thing to do. It's not just because it's an interesting land to visit, another form of Disneyland, but because it's a path to freedom. It's a path to some of the most beautiful and profound and meaningful transformations a person can do in their life. And to overcome, as the Buddha said, lamentation, despair, grief, sorrow, to really release, and the Buddhist word is really to release the heart from what keeps it shackled, keeps it in prison, keeps it tied down, keeps it hidden, keeps it afraid, keeps it restricted. To release the mind, the heart. And it's a beautiful thing to do. And so coming into the here land is the process of doing that. Only in the world of here can that release really happen fully. The about land doesn't release much. The about land can be spent a lot of time thinking about how to get released, thinking about freedom, thinking about how great it's going to be, thinking about how I'm so great that I'm already free, thinking about myself. It's all about. And it's a kind of a deadening world. You spend too much time in the world of aboutness. It's not three-dimensional. It's not really where life, the lived life, is not found in about something. The lived life is found here. And so one of the things we're doing here is learning to come into the here. Now, when the Buddha gave his instructions for mindfulness practice, in the Donald referred to the text called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness. As the Buddha started to give his instructions, the first thing he said is the most important and is mostly overlooked, mostly just kind of glanced right over and no one refers to it. The first thing he said, here. Here. And then he started giving instructions. So here. And the word for here in Pali, and I'm going to teach you some Pali. You ready to learn? Ida. Isn't that a great word? Ida. I think it's one of those great words like Allah, Rama, Jehovah. All end with this ah. And imagine here being a place of ah, Ida, Ida. And sometimes when I sit and meditate, I use the word here as a note to be here. I find it a very meaningful mental note because it overcomes my tendency sometimes to have my practice be about something different than it's about. So, you know, practice is about getting concentrated. Practice is about making things different so I can have a good experience. It's about getting rid of something. So I'm kind of in that world of aboutness and I'm trying to negotiate everything. But the word here, ida, and then when I say that word, I just allow the here to be as it is. Or try to let it just be here as it is. And then I notice, what is it like? So if I'm agitated, my mind is wandering a lot, I say the word here, and then I say, oh, here's a mind which is agitated. Here's a mind that's wandering a lot. This is what it's like. And then usually I have to say it again pretty quickly. Here. Here, this is what it's like. This is what it's like. And one of the things I encounter in that, this is what it's like, is the forces of the mind, the thoughts and everything that are involved in aboutness or about trying to change things or wanting things different or leaning forward or all the things that that Heather talked about, the mind get caught up and trying to make things different than how they are. To be caught up in making wanting things to be different, to be caught in that is painful. And I find there's something very profound about settling back into here and discovering what's here. It's also very respectful. Why do you think you know what you should be experiencing that's different from your lived experience of this moment? Here. This. And then you get to discover all the ways in which you run away or attack or are afraid or something. And then you get to feel the here-ness of fear or the here-ness of desire or the here-ness of ill will or the here-ness of restlessness and all these things. So what makes the hindrances hindrances is not that they, not those qualities in and of themselves, but how they hinder attention. So for example, desire in and of itself is not a hindrance. Desire is a hindrance when desire is hindering. So we don't have to get rid of desire to show up here. We just have to develop the mindfulness strong enough to really know clearly here, I'm having desire. That's a very important distinction because if you think the practice is about getting rid of the desire, then you miss the opportunity to really be present for here in a clear and direct way. And it's the here-ness, the awareness that can be here, that is the key. It's the awareness that can be here that is the key to opening up this path of vipassana. It's not about changing necessarily how things, what your experience is. So with the hindrances are inevitable visitors. They're so common that it's best not to take them personally. A personal failing. Like you're the first person on the block who has a desire, you know. Or the first person who's ever had some kind of negative judgments about someone else. I mean, you know, that's a kind of conceit, right? My negative judgmental mind is like so terrible, I'm the worst. That's pretty conceited. And it's bad enough in itself. But not to take it personally. Just this is what the mind does. The mind has desire, the mind has ill will, the mind gets tired, the mind gets full of doubt. Just what happens from time to time. Some mind seems to specialize in some of them more than others. But that's not your business. Except your business is to notice it, to know it. Because the hindrances are such common human phenomena, the task for a mindfulness student is not to dismiss them, not to get rid of them quickly, which is often the tendency. If only I can get rid of this and be on to the real stuff, the real practice. The task of a mindful student is if a hindrance arises, your task is to patiently, willingly turn towards it and get to know it. And that getting to know it, doing that does two things. It hopefully turn towards it to be here with that. Discover what it's like just to be here in a very simple way without needing to be any way different. And just feel, here is someone having desire. This is what desire is like. And discover what that ability to have a here presence, here awareness, just to be here and be aware is so important, so key. So you have an opportunity to try to discover that. The other is we start to learn about what the hindrance is all about. And it's really important to become familiar with the hindrances. In fact, Vipassana students are supposed to become like world-class experts on the hindrances. And the only way you can do that is by studying them, not by getting rid of them quickly. So that's the bad news, is to take the time to get to know them. Don't be in a hurry. It's really useful. Take your time with what is happening in the present moment. There's no hurry. And it's certainly not a competition to get somewhere fast. Or sometimes I say that Vipassana is a really great competitive sport because we all arrive in the present moment at the same time. Are you ready? On your mark? Get set? Go! We didn't leave anybody behind. So after the Buddha says here in the instructions for mindfulness, he goes on, the next thing he says, that the meditator sets aside greed and distress for the world. So after saying here, he says, you put aside greed and distress in the world. When I first encountered that phrase, I was kind of confused by it because I thought, that's why I was doing mindfulness. And now I'm being told I have to do that first before I can do mindfulness. But this is how I understand it. In order to do mindfulness practice, you have to be willing to turn the attention away from aboutness, or turn the attention away from the object of your attention, which is what the world is about here in this phrase, and instead focus on what the lived experience is. So if I'm thinking a lot about the interview I'm going to have with the teacher, which is a great, some people, I found that was a great place for my practice to grow because I had a lot of things come up for me. Some of you, I'm sure, as well. It's not to feel bad about the issues that come up preparing for an interview, but take them on as part of the practice. Maybe even talk about it with your teacher. So you don't have to stop, say you're nervous about your interview. And as I'll tell you that the first time I had an interview with a teacher, with my Zen teacher, formal interview, I was so nervous I couldn't speak. And my teacher said, Gil, breathe deeply. So, I know what it can be like. So you don't have to stop thinking about the interview, but the interview is an object of attention, object of thought. You turn the attention around 180 degrees and feel the lived experience here of someone who's anxious, someone is having thoughts about interview. Or if you have desire, say you have sexual fantasy desires, that's fine. You don't have to dismiss that, but you need to understand that the practice is not found in that world of aboutness, in those fantasies. The practice is found by turning the attention 180 degrees around, or bringing it in close in, bringing it back to the here land, to here, and feeling what it's like, being present for what it's like to be desiring. If you're mesmerized by the object of what you're thinking about, the object of your fantasy, you won't feel the lived experience of what it's like to be desiring. If you have ill will, aversion, anger, hostility towards someone or something, I've had hostility towards my Zafu. And, I mean, how could they get so hard? I mean, it's like, after a few days, it feels like concrete. And fantasies about what I'm going to do to that Zafu. And so again, you don't have to feel like you're bad about having those angry thoughts. You don't have to judge yourself negatively, or this is a fine place to be angry. But in order to do the practice, you have to understand the key is not to stay absorbed or caught up in the world of aboutness, the Zafu, but rather to turn around or bring yourself in close to feel what it's like to be a person having ill will, to feel the heat, the tension, the tightness, the agitation, and all those things. And discover the here-ness of that. Be present for that. And explore that, what's going on there. So for each of these hindrances have a lot to do about the world of aboutness. They usually have a fair amount to do with thinking, especially the first two and the last one. Desires usually have an object of desire. And if you're involved in the object, you're involved in the world of aboutness. If you turn back and focus on the subject of being the one who has desire, then you're in the practice. You have ill will usually has an object. And so can you turn around and really feel this, the immediacy here of that experience of having ill will? So when we do that, we can discover a range of things. We certainly discover how thinking is part of the hindrance. And with thinking, we might discover that there's beliefs connected to it. If I get this, then if I have that object of desire fulfilled, then I'll feel better. If they have potatoes for supper, I'll have it made for the rest of the evening. That's my belief, so I'll start thinking about potatoes. Or there might be, I know people have told me that they've gotten involved in some kind of fantasy, very pleasant fantasy, desire fantasy, because they felt, well, it was a rough afternoon, I deserve a break. And so they kind of go off into their fantasy, they kind of get a nice little vacation. And so thinking, so there's beliefs, ideas of what we need and don't need come into play. It's interesting to look at that. There's emotions that are connected. It's interesting to explore the range of emotions connected to the hindrances. And in fact, this is where, again, I think that calling the hindrances coverings is interesting. Because sometimes a hindrance will cover something more deeply. Like sometimes when there's desire, it covers some deeper emptiness or longing or fear. So for example, the syndrome of going for food when you're lonely or feeling sad, the desire for food, for comfort. But the deeper thing is the feeling of loneliness or emptiness that might be there. And the more profound thing to do is to come in close and feel the loneliness or the sadness that might be there, rather than being caught up in the world about what you're desiring. There's energetics in the body. There's all these sensations and feelings and tensions and movement in the body that goes on. It's interesting to watch it, like when you go down the hill for lunch. Imagine some of you's desire kicks in. It's interesting to watch what happens to your body as you're walking down towards lunch. My teacher in Thailand said, don't do anything that takes you out of your body. I discovered a lot of what he meant by that when I went to lunch. And I found that I was a foot in front of my body, you know, heading towards food. The food would, you know, I lost my presence, my body, as I was projected ahead. Maybe some of you can stay in your body going down the hill. You can stay in your body standing in line until you pick up your plate and you look down and there's only one piece of tempeh left. My favorite. And that's just so tempting to lose your body. To lean forward. You feel what goes on in your body. It's leaning forward. It's contraction, this tightness, holding your plate a little bit tighter, hoping, praying that they hate tempeh, so they'd save it for you. What I'm trying to point out is the idea of studying what the phenomena of desiring is like. Explore it. Go into it. Be present for it. The more you explore it and are present for it, chances are the more free you'll become of it. Not that it goes away, but you won't be a slave to it. You won't be pushed around by it. With time, the mindfulness gets stronger, and you become independent of these forces. And then they're no longer hindering. They're just desire. But desire doesn't push you around. Desires can be a dime a dozen, and you don't have to be pulled into them. It's possible to be aware of the authority that these hindrances have, like desire, ill will, doubts also. We invest so much authority into it, but the idea that it's truthful is not questioned. If I have a desire, it must be true. Thank you. And off I go, running off after my desire. Why is it true? It's possible to feel the granting of authority, of power to these things, and it's possible to choose not to grant it. One of the interesting things to study is how we identify with these things. We use it in some way or other to define who I am. And that's another way we invest or power authority into these things, by somehow saying, using it to define myself positively or negatively, taking it personally in some way. Oh, you know, this is terrible that I should be having desires or fantasies like this. I'm really embarrassing. I'm a bad person. Or, you know, I'm a lousy person for being so judgmental. To have those kind of judgments we added on top grants a power, gives power to those thoughts that don't have to be there. If you do grant power, if you do make it personally, that's okay too. Here's a person who's taking it so personally. This is what it's like to take it personally. Isn't this interesting? What's this feel like? What's this objective experience of taking something personally? You're here and present at that point. The first two hindrances, desire and aversion, desire and ill will, are very powerful forces in our lives, for and against, wanting and not wanting. Longing, it can be deep-seated longing for something that brings us into the world of aboutness as opposed to being here. Some people depend on desire and aversion to be energized. I call it desire and aversion, the caffeine of the soul. And some people really, just like some people need to go to horror movies to get energized, some people keep themselves going by having those desires, wanting this and that, and not wanting that, and criticizing. And they build up tremendous strong senses of self, self-definition through desire and what we want and don't want, and who I share my desires with, who I share my aversions with, who I don't, and all that. It's a very, very complicated world. As that world of desiring and ill will quiets down to some degree, some people find they go through a difficult transition, just as you would if you stop drinking caffeine. There might be go through withdrawals, maybe a couple of days where things are kind of rough and headachy or kind of uncomfortable. Some people start feeling that discomfort and they take refuge back into desire and ill will. In fact, sometimes desire and ill will is a strategy to try to avoid feeling discomfort. Or it functions that way. And so part of this nobility of practicing here, of showing up, is the willingness to go through those transitions, go through the withdrawals that might be here. And so one of the things I want to emphasize this evening is that the fact that you might judge your meditation practice as getting worse might not be true. Sometimes things have to get, as things unwind or we let go of certain things, it's habits of mind, we go through these transition periods, which can be a little bit tough to go through. And it takes a lot of patience then to wait it out. But if you come back and really deeply trust that the most powerful and beneficial thing you can do is say here, just here. Here's a person who's feeling uncomfortable, who's restless. Here's a person who's feeling tired. So one of the most common, one common symptom when desire and ill will is no longer keeping the mind going and spinning is it crashes, the mind crashes, and so sloth and torpor can set in, tiredness, lethargy. Sometimes lethargy or sloth and torpor arises because what gave us meaning, kept us charged and gave meaning, no longer is giving us meaning. But we have nothing to replace it with for a while. And so we just kind of feel kind of deflated. Or we feel discouraged. Or we feel disappointed. We have strong desire and the desire is not fulfilled. And one result of that is sometimes things drop. Sloth and torpor as a hindrance does not mean that there's not enough, doesn't mean a lack of available energy to practice. It means we haven't tapped into the available energy that's there. I call it sloth and torpor like this, my Sears mind. Because when I was a little kid, my mom would take me to Sears to buy clothes. And I hated it. I would get so tired. So tired. Oh, it was so tiring to be in those clothing stores, the smell, and oh, I didn't have any energy, and oh, please. And then we'd leave Sears, my mom would say, you know, should we buy some ice cream? Boy, did I have energy. It wasn't very far away. So, resistance can take the form of sloth and torpor. Disappointment. Fear can kind of creep in there also sometimes. But so again, so sloth and torpor happens, not personal. Lethargy, resistance. It's hard with sloth and torpor, but to turn around, 180 degree turn, and then, okay, and the task here is to say here. I get to study sloth. Great. I get to study tiredness. This is what it's like. And to really feel it and explore it, you might discover that also covers something. Don't go digging so much, but if you stay really present, you might see, oh, it's more than I realized here in this tired state. Or there might be restlessness. Sometimes we don't get what we want. Our desire is not fulfilled, or we're, you know, just we're struggling with ill will, or we have aversion to something, and what we have aversion to comes anyway. Sometimes the mind or the body starts getting really restless and agitated and worked up. Sometimes on retreats, we get worked up and a lot of nervous or agitated energy can course through our system for no discernible reason whatsoever. Sometimes the mind then gets into the about world. I wonder what this is about. And we start analyzing and trying to guess and figure out. There's no need to analyze and guess and just go back into the about world. What we do here is simpler than the world of aboutness can ever be about. It's just here. Oh, here is restlessness. This is what it's like. And you might feel, as you're here, this is what it's like, to feel the voices and the ideas, the beliefs in your mind that says, this is not good enough. This is terrible. I should be someplace else. And all those movements of mind to run away or to do something should be studied, should be felt. To be seen clearly for what they are, so that the mind of awareness, the mind that can be here and present and know, becomes stronger than the thoughts, than the beliefs, what should happen, shouldn't happen. We keep coming back in this practice, we keep coming back over and over and over again to hear, this is what it's like, to hear, so the knowing, the awareness of what's here can get stronger and stronger. Things can change as we practice, we get more concentrated, more still, a variety of things can happen. But the key thing that can happen is this freedom that comes when the awareness, the mindfulness gets strong enough that the mindfulness is independent of what's being experienced, where the mindfulness is not pushed around. It's like this ballast or this strength or this force or this power of mindfulness that can handle anything. It's like mindfulness becomes like really big, lots of room in mindfulness, and whatever arises can arise. One analogy I like is for this, being, it's not so much a matter of having things again be different, but making more room for whatever the experience we're having. So the analogy is, if you go into a small, teeny little elevator, and it's you and three really, really large, I don't know what, messy, sloppy, smelly people with ketchup all the way down their shirts and, you know, and breath and, you know, and everything. And you have to get in the middle of these people and they're squeezed in and it feels kind of claustrophobic. But then the elevators open up and you all spread out into this huge, beautiful cathedral-like room, just vast room. It's just you and those three people spread out all over the room. And when you're spread out and have all that space, then it's easy to love humanity. So part of the function of mindfulness is to create more room. Let the mindfulness get stronger. Be present for here. Relax. Allow it to be. To make room is a very different movement than to change what's there. Make room for desire. Make room for ill will. Not to indulge in it. Not to get swept away in the world of aboutness, but to learn to wake up, to be here, and recognize, oh, here, this is what desire is like. I've heard about that. I heard it might happen. Ill will, restlessness, sloth, and torpor. The strongest hindrance is doubt. And the reason we say it's the strongest is that, in terms of practice, is the other hindrances can be about all kinds of stuff. But the hindrance of doubt has specifically doubt connected to the practice itself. So doubt about this practice, doubt about this is the right time to be practicing, doubt about your ability to do the practice, doubt about the teachers, doubt about the teachings, doubt about the place, doubt about your shawl, doubt about the zafu. You know, there's a lot of things you can doubt. That if you start out as strong enough, it powerful interference with just a continuity of being mindful and being present. We get pulled, doubt is a powerful magnet into the world of aboutness. And it has a lot of authority in it. We invest a lot of meaning, a lot of in it. It must be true. And then, you know, I knew one person, one of the Spirit Rock teachers, I won't mention by name, who had a huge doubt attack on a retreat and didn't recognize it until after she had bought a ticket, airplane ticket, and gotten on the plane to return to her home state. That was kind of slow. You know, if she had just said here sooner, you know, she wouldn't have saved the expense of getting a special ticket. But doubt can be very powerful. One of the very, I think, really interesting movements to do with doubt is if you really in the throes of really good, juicy doubt that really has you by your neck, and is to just do it one better and doubt the doubt. If you're gonna be doubting anyway, just do it better. Be more thorough. And doubt the doubt. But if you can't do that, then here, this is what it's like to have doubt. And you do this not just for yourself, you do this as a gift to others as well. These are universal forces. And the more that you can become familiar and know what this is about, know how it affects your body, how it affects your emotions, how it affects your mind, your thoughts, and everything, the more you can be familiar with it, the more you're helping other people understand it. You're modeling a different way of living. Someday you might be able to share what you've learned, your wisdom, because you've studied it so well. We don't do this just for ourselves. So you have a good bout of doubt, even if it's true. You say, great. It's not just about for me. This is a chance to study. Let me deal about the truthness and the falseness later. Maybe I'll bring it up with a teacher in an interview to check it out. But for the time being, I'm going to be present here and get to know it, as opposed to being pulled into the world of aboutness, the thoughts of what I'm doubting, the thing I'm doubting about. Donald yesterday talked about coming back into our body, being in our body. And that's also what I'm trying to talk about here today. The body is the fantastic friend, as Ananda said, for ourselves, for our practice. The body is a tremendous reservoir of wisdom, it's a tremendous reservoir of process, of trust, of support, of refuge. And when you have the hindrances come up and do this 180-degree turn back to the subjective experience, to what it's really like, you come back and really feel it in your body. Let the body hold it. Not just to feel it in the body, but let the body hold it. Let the body kind of be the container of it, be the support of it. Let the room for these things be greater room in the body. So where do you feel that desire or the anger? Do you feel the anger in the pit of your stomach? Then feel it there. Let the stomach hold it. If the stomach's not big enough, let the whole torso hold it. If the torso's not big enough for it, let the whole body behold the anger. If your body's not big enough for all your anger, it's okay. Then make it Spirit Rock hold it. If Spirit Rock's not big enough to hold your anger, let it be the state of California. And if that's not big enough, just keep going out until you just have a lot of space to just let it be and feel and not kind of caught in a struggling match with it, wrestling match with it. Some of you might not care for my practice of saying here. More traditionally, in our scene, we would use mental noting. We would say, oh, desire. Name it, desire, desire. For the same purpose, to really come back and feel it, to recognize it, to let the mindfulness become stronger. Sloth, tired lethargy, to name it as a way of coming back, as a way of nudging yourself, encouraging yourself, here, come close, be intimate with the experience. You're not intimate if you're thinking about it. You're intimate if you're in your body feeling it here. Relax in the body. Soften here. So some of you might find it very useful to use the mental noting when these hindrances come up and to name it. There's something very powerful about noting. The ancient fairy tales or stories where if you name the dragon loses its power. It works also sometimes with the hindrances. And one of the power that these dragons or the hindrances have is the power of our identification with them, defining ourselves by them. And there can be something about the naming where you kind of, in a sense, kind of step away from it or step away from identifying with it and just recognize, oh, here, doubt. So some of you might find it helpful to do the noting. So to conclude, for those of you who started, especially in March, we mostly been emphasizing the breath as a grounding, as a way of beginning the practice here, getting centered and stabilized. It's very, very effective to be in the breath. And we'll expand the instructions to include the body and emotions and such things. But one of the key principles of mindfulness is to turn into whatever is happening. Not to dismiss anything or push something away or say this shouldn't be happening. But whatever the difficulties are, it can be very effective to bring it into the practice, to include it, to turn towards it in a sense. And one of the ways to do that is through this 180-degree turn away from thinking about it to sensing it, feeling it, making room for it here in the body. And just being here with this, discovering what it is, discovering what goes on, discovering what your reactions in relationship to it is here. Whatever difficulties you're having, those difficulties become the practice. And once they become the practice, they're not difficulties to your practice anymore. They are the practice. And that's been one of the very powerful lessons I learned through Vipassana, was the lesson of including everything as the practice. As opposed to thinking practice is one thing, and my difficulties are an unfortunate other thing that shouldn't be happening. Who knows why anything is supposed to be happening? It's enough for me that it's happening. And then to use that for the practice of mindfulness, training in mindfulness, development of mindfulness, training in being here, discovering this amazing jewel, this amazing treasure that's only discovered in the living experience of here. So let's take a few moments to be here, for you to turn that 180 degrees around from the world of aboutness, about the talk, and to feel, sense, experience the here-ness of yourself now. inhabit the land of here.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.